You are listening to Radio I, your source for printed news and information. This service is intended for listeners who are blind, visually impaired, or have other disabilities that prevent them from reading. All materials are read as written and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of Radio I. For further information about this service, please call 859-422-6390 or visit our website at www.radioeye.org. That's www.radioeye.org.
Welcome to the reading of the Lexington Herald Leader. Today is Thursday, March 23rd, 2023, and your reader is Woody Snowden with Bill Sally at the Master Controls. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Now, from our studios located in the Northside branch of the Lexington Public Library, please join me for this live reading of the Lexington Herald Leader, donated to Radio Eye by the publishers. We'll start this morning with the weather, and we're going to focus on WKYT's five-day forecast. Today, cloudy, a high of 74 and a low of 57. That's going to be warmer than it's been for the last several days. The real feel is 70 degrees, and the UV index is 2. Tomorrow, Friday, 64 degrees is the high, 59 degrees is the low. We can expect rain, a thunderstorm, a real feel temperature of 63 degrees, and a UV index of 1. Saturday, partly sunny, with some rain mixed in. 65 degrees is the high, 39 degrees is the low. We can expect strong winds. The real feel temperature will be 63 degrees, and the UV index 3. Sunday, partly sunny, a high of 61, a low of 47. The real feel on Sunday will be 63 degrees, and our UV index will be 6. Monday, 64 degrees is the high, 39 degrees is the low. Occasional rain, real feel temperature 63 degrees, the UV index 3. Turning now to our almanac. Our temperature on Tuesday, the high was 60 degrees, the low was 32 degrees. Our normal high is 58 degrees, and our normal low is 37 degrees. Last year on that day, our high was 70 degrees, and our low was 39 degrees. The record high for the date is 83 degrees, which was set in 1907, and our record low for this date was 15 degrees, set in 1986. Precipitation on Tuesday was negligible, about 0.3% of an inch. The month to date, precipitation is 2.14 inches. Our normal is 3.08 inches. The year to date, 12.15 inches. Our normal year to date is 10.14 inches. Last year to date, 16.56 inches. Of rainfall precipitation, rather. The record for this date was 1.12 inches, which was set in 1955. Sunrise this morning was 7:38 a.m. Sunset at 7:53 p.m. Moonrise at 8:46 a.m. and moonset at 10:24 p.m. The lunar cycles. Our first half moon is expected on March the 28th. The full moon expected April the 6th, the last half moon expected April the 13th, and the new moon April the 20th. Pollen levels are low. The main offender is mold. Weather trivia for today. What is the cause of the four seasons? The answer, the tilt of the Earth's axis and the Earth's movement around the sun. We're going to transition now to the headlines for Thursday, March 23rd, 2023, in the Lexington Herald Leader. And our headlines are as follows. Kentucky State University misused funds, the audit finds. Firm that did Google headquarters to design new $51 million distillery. The Fed is facing a blurrier outlook as it meets to weigh rate hike. And lastly, Russian missiles, drones kill Ukrainian civilians. The first article is entitled Kentucky State University Misused Funds, Audit Finds, by Monica Cast of the Herald Leader. A special examination of Kentucky State University's finances revealed widespread overspending, a lack of financial control, and misuse of credit cards and university funds, according to a report released by the Office of the Auditor of Public Accounts Wednesday. The 117-page report found numerous issues related to finances and the university's finance office, including poor internal controls and communication, failure to ensure an effective budgeting process, and widespread overspending and credit card usage. The report identified more than $1.3 million in credit card transactions with little to no documentation, and in one instance, the use of a fund that was meant for faculty, staff, and student recognition was used to pay for the rental of Kentucky Castle for a board retreat. The special examination looked at KSU's financial activity between July 1, 2018 and June 30, 2021, when KSU was under the leadership of former President M. Christopher Brown II. The report identified 20 issues related to finances at the university and noted inadequate or non-existent record keeping and continuously high rate of employee turnover. Making the audit more difficult to conduct, according to the report. Improper documentation of funds put over $3 million in federal funds at risk, and KSU failed to implement the most basic level of internal control necessary to prevent overspending. According to the report also raised concerns about the former executive vice president for finance, who was seemingly employed by two universities at the same time for 2 months in 2021. The many problems found in our examination did not happen overnight, and frankly, they will not be solved overnight. What is clear is that past practices at KSU detailed in our exam report must come to an end, said Kentucky State Auditor Mike Harmon, who is also campaigning to be the Republican candidate for governor. The examination is being referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Kentucky and the Kentucky Office of the Attorney General, and portions of the report related to federal grant spending will be sent to the U.S. Department of Treasury and the U.S. Department of Education, Harmon said. Interim KSU President Ronald Johnson said he and the Board of Regents have been working to address financial issues within the university, but the issues facing the university are extreme. I draw on experience of 40-plus years in industries, in government, and of course in the context of HBCUs, and I can be honest, I've just not seen this level of failure in terms of checks and balances, Johnson said. Johnson said the university and its leadership are working to make the necessary changes and move forward. I assure you that we are working, and with great haste, to ensure that the public trust in Kentucky State University is maintained, or essentially returned, Johnson said. The release of today's report presents a moment of tremendous difficulty and great potential. Lack of financial control and misuse of federal funds among issues. KSU failed to fully implement and maintain an effective system of internal controls over its financial and administrative operations, the report said. KSU's administration for the period examined, July 1, 2018 through June 30, 2021, permitted and enabled poor fiscal management practices to persist, including excess spending above budgets, consistent reliance on credit cards and charge accounts, allowing for funds to be spent without encumbrance, growing outstanding accounts payable, incomplete accounting records, and an inadequate accounting system. The report also found the former president and board were given inaccurate information about the university's finances, and in 2021, the board was told the university was on track to end the fiscal year in the black. However, later that year, over $15 million of prior year expenditures were carried over into the next fiscal year. Additionally, no written policies and procedures for the budget process exist, and a consistent procedure was not followed in developing the budget, and internal audits were only performed intermittently, and at times actively delayed from being performed. Spending of federal grant funds was also a concern outlined in the report. When a university receives those funds, there are strict requirements for how they are spent. KSU's inadequate record keeping meant that many federal grant expenditures could not be verified. KSU did not maintain a strong internal control system over federal grant expenditures to ensure compliance, according to the report. In addition, some internal controls were deliberately circumvented by KSU executive staff. Among the funds reportedly misused were the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund, as well as other COVID-19 funds and grants for historically black universities. If federal awarding agencies find the funds were spent inappropriately, KSU could be required to repay those funds, which total more than $3.3 million, according to the report. The report also raised concerns about the former president's and administration's spending. Records show nearly $100,000 was spent on supplemental medical insurance for select members of the former administration, including Brown and former executive vice president for finance, Douglas Allen. Over $84,000 was given to Brown in December 2018 as a retroactive payment for housing to cover the cost of private housing in which the president did not live, according to the report. The university also paid nearly $4,000 to cover utilities for Brown and a one-time payment of $12,500 to Brown without explanation. Not only were these payments unjustified, but the spending was also irresponsible given the financial condition of the university at the time, according to the report. The report outlines a long list of recommendations for the university, including stronger communication among the university's budget and spending, tighter controls on credit card spending, establishing an organized system for financial and operational records, including written policies and procedures, training for staff on how to use and retain documents, improvements of how federal grant funds are administrated. Concerns raised about former finance officers' employment. The report also found that Allen, who is now the Vice President of Business and Finance at Tennessee State University, was employed by both universities at the same time from May to June 2021, violating KSU's conflict of commitment policy. The lack of prior approval notwithstanding, considering the role and full-time work responsibilities held simultaneously at KSU and TSU, it is questionable whether the former EVP for finance was able to fulfill his full-time job responsibilities at KSU over the two-month period, according to the report. Allen was found to be sending emails from his KSU account to his TSU email account in late May 2021, including a presentation on KSU's internal endowed funds, according to records found during the investigation. From the two universities, he was making over $37,000 per month. The former KSU payroll director also told state auditors Allen demanded she pay out his full vacation balance of approximately $34,000, though that went against university policy. The report recommends the university seek legal counsel to determine options that may be available to recoup any payment for services not rendered by the employee. KSU's budget shortfall, leadership changes. The university has been under scrutiny for leadership and financial challenges in the last several years, with the special examination from the auditor announced last May. In 2022, KSU received $23 million from the state to address its budget shortfall. The university has been without a permanent president since Brown resigned in 2021, although the search for a new president resumed earlier this month. As part of the $23 million, the university also had to create a management improvement plan outlining guidelines for improving the operations of the school. The plan includes a complete review of KSU policies and procedures, academic programs, and the accounting and fiscal reporting systems. The university's Board of Regents was overhauled via a Senate bill last year, and the new board has spent much of its time attempting to get the university on sound financial footing. After Brown's resignation, he and the university sued each other. In his lawsuit against the university, the former president said he was fired without cause and is owed $270,000 in severance pay. In its lawsuit against Brown, the university said the former president failed to fulfill his duties and left the university in a poor financial state and with a damaged reputation. KSU is the only public historically black university in the state and is also a land-grant university. A special examination of KSU was conducted by the auditor's office in 2000, which detailed 16 findings related to KSU's financial controls. Our next article from the front page of the Lexington Herald Leader this morning is entitled "Firm That Did Google Headquarters to Design New $51 Million Distillery." The article is written by Janet Patton of the Herald Leader. A planned $51 million distillery coming to Georgetown will be an architectural innovation from the same Danish firm that designed Google's headquarters and the Lego brand museum. Blue Run, which announced in August 2022 that it planned to build a whiskey operation in Georgetown, released preliminary designs by Bjarke Ingels Group. Called Meander, the design shows one swooping half-mile-long building housing the entire operation, including distilling, aging, and blending. The design is meant to evoke Georgetown's Royal Spring, according to a news release. Construction of the 35,000-square-foot Kentucky distillery and a 20,000-square-foot rickhouse will begin this year in Lane's Run Business Park in Scott County, next to Toyota. It's expected to open in 2025 and bring at least 45 full-time jobs. In 2022, the company received approval for up to $850,000 in various tax incentives from the Kentucky Economic Development Finance Authority to build the distillery. Blue Run Spirits has introduced 13 bourbon and rye whiskey releases since the company launched in October 2020, selling 21,000 9-liter cases in 2022 and winning awards along the way. Many of their releases sell out in minutes online. We are thrilled to be able to reveal an early look of Bjarke Ingels Group's design for the new Blue Run Spirits Distillery in Georgetown, giving everyone a glimpse at where we are heading in developing a welcoming, unexpected, and modern facility with a true focus on sustainability, said Blue Run Spirits CEO and co-founder Mike Montgomery. This will be a game-changing addition to Blue Run's long-range business plans, allowing us to meet forecasted and unforeseen demand while also giving our whiskey director, Shaylin Gammon, and liquid advisor, Jim Rutledge, turning the page, a home base of operations. In June 2022, Blue Run hired Gammon, who created the best whiskey of 2021 at Wild Turkey, to work with former Four Roses master distiller Jim Rutledge to elevate Blue Run's current inventory. Bjarke Ingels Group is based in Copenhagen and New York and has offices in London, Barcelona, and Shenzhen. Besides the Google headquarters and Lego brand museum, BIG's projects include the Audemars Piguet Museum and Hotel, the San Pellegrino flagship factory, and world-renowned Copenhagen restaurant Noma. For Blue Run, we have boiled the entire process of whiskey making down to a single linear sequence from distilling to maturing to bottling. The half-mile-long process meanders through the gentle hillsides, creating bends and banks, inlets and outlooks. A single shingled roof of photovoltaic tiles twists and turns to maintain optimal orientation, even as the activities underneath require grandeur or intimacy. In the same way, the Royal Spring is shaped by how the water flows through it. Blue Run Distillery is shaped by the flow of the whiskey and the processes and people who make it, said founder and creative director, BIG, Bjarke Ingels, in the release. Design is at the center of everything we do at Blue Run, from our liquid to our bottle to our new distillery, Montgomery said in the release. The design BIG has developed is in dialogue with the landscape, the meandering path to making whiskey, and a manifestation of the bold, distinct, and inviting ethos that signifies Blue Run Spirits. Returning again to the front page, we're going to pick up our third article of the morning, Fed facing blurrier outlook as it meets to weigh rate hike, by Christopher Rugarber of the Associated Press, Washington. The Federal Reserve is grappling with a hazier economic picture, clouded by turmoil in the banking industry and still high inflation, just as it meets to decide whether to keep raising interest rates or declare a pause. Most Fed watchers expected the central bank to announce on Wednesday a relatively modest quarter-point hike in its benchmark rate, its ninth increase since March of last year. Yet for the first time in recent memory, there remained some uncertainty about what the Fed would announce when it issues its policy statement. The central bank will not only have to decide whether to extend its year-long streak of rate hikes despite the jitters roiling the financial industry. The Fed's policymakers will also try to peer into the future and forecast the likely path of growth, employment, inflation, and their own interest rates. Those forecasts will be particularly difficult this time. In their most recent forecast in December, Fed officials projected that they would raise their short-term rate to about 5.1% by the end of this year, roughly a half point above the current level. Some Fed watchers expected the policymakers on Wednesday to raise that forecast to 5.3%, but the upheaval in the banking industry has made any expectations far less certain. The Fed was meeting less than 2 weeks after Silicon Valley Bank.
Turning the page.
Failed in the second largest bank collapse in American history. That shock was followed by the failure of another major bank, Signature Bank. A third, First Republic Bank, was saved from collapse by a $30 billion cash infusion. Given the heightened uncertainties overhanging the financial system, there was a small chance the Fed could decide not to issue its usual quarterly projections. If the Fed did raise its key rate by a quarter point on Wednesday, it would reach roughly 4.9%, the highest point in nearly 16 years. Early this month, Fed Chair Jerome Powell had said in congressional testimony that a half-point rate increase would be possible at this week's meeting. The banking crisis has suddenly upended that outlook. It will be a tough call for the 11 Fed officials who voted on the rate decision. With hiring still strong, consumers still spending, and inflation still elevated, a rate hike would normally be a straightforward move. Not this time. The Fed was expected to treat inflation and financial turmoil as two separate problems, to be managed simultaneously by separate tools: higher rates to address inflation and greater Fed lending to banks to calm financial turmoil. Complicating matters will be the difficulty in determining the impact on the economy of the collapse of Silicon Valley and Signature. The Fed, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and Treasury Department agreed to insure all the deposits at those banks, including those above the $250,000 cap. The Fed also created a new lending program to ensure that banks can access cash to repay depositors if needed. But economists warn that many mid-sized and small banks, in order to conserve capital, will likely become more cautious in their lending. A tightening of bank credit could, in turn, reduce business spending on new software, equipment, and buildings. It could also make it harder for consumers to obtain auto or other loans. Some economists worry that such a slowdown in lending could be enough to tip the economy into recession. Wall Street traders are betting that a weaker economy will force the Fed to start cutting rates this summer. Futures markets have priced in 3/4-point cuts by the end of the year. The Fed would likely welcome slower growth, which would help cool inflation, but few economists are sure what the effects would be of a pullback in bank lending. Other major central banks are also seeking to tame high inflation without worsening the financial instability caused by the two U.S. bank collapses and a hasty sale of the troubled Swiss bank Credit Suisse to its rival UBS. Even with the anxieties surrounding the global banking system, the Bank of England faces pressure to approve an 11th straight rate hike Thursday, with annual inflation having reached 10.4%. And the European Central Bank, saying Europe's banking sector was resilient, last week raised its benchmark rate by a half point to combat inflation of 8.5%. At the same time, the ECB president, Christine Lagarde, has shifted to an open-ended stance regarding further increases. In light of uncertainty, she said, we are neither committed to raise further, nor are we finished with hiking rates. In the United States, most recent data still points to a solid economy and rampant hiring. Employers added 311,000 jobs in February, the government said earlier this month. And while the unemployment rate rose from 3.4% to a still low 3.6%, that mostly reflected an influx of new job seekers who were not immediately hired. Consumer spending was robust in January, fueled in part by a large cost of living adjustment for 70 million recipients of Social Security and other benefits. The Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta projects that the economy will have expanded at a healthy annual rate of 3.2% in the first 3 months of this year. Finishing up with our front page articles in today's Lexington Herald Leader, we have an article entitled, Russian Missiles, Drones Kill Ukrainian Civilians. The article is written by Hanna Arirova of the Associated Press. Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukraine's president posted video Wednesday showing what he said was a Russian missile slamming into an apartment building in the southeastern city of Zaporizhia. killing at least one person after Moscow's forces launched exploding drones before dawn that killed another seven at a student dormitory near Kyiv. The video posted by President Volodymyr Zelensky to Telegram appeared to be from CCTV cameras that captured the moment a missile hit the nine-story residential block near a busy road. Ukrainian media showed charred apartments on several stories of the affected buildings with flames billowing from some of them. Two children were among the wounded, said Zaporizhia City Council Secretary Anatoly Kurtiev, adding that 25 needed hospital treatment with three in critical condition. Russia is shelling the city with bestial savagery, Zelensky wrote to accompany the video. Residential areas where ordinary people and children live are being fired at. He appealed for countries to increase pressure on the Kremlin to give up its invasion of Ukraine. The city is about 60 miles from the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, Europe's largest, which has previously come under threat during the war. Russia has denied targeting residential areas, even though artillery and rocket strikes hit apartment buildings and civilian infrastructure on a daily basis. Earlier Wednesday, an overnight drone attack partially destroyed a high school and two dormitories in the city of Rzeszów, south of the Ukrainian capital, officials said. It wasn't clear how many people were in the dormitories at the time. The body of a 40-year-old man was pulled from the rubble on a dormitory's fifth floor, according to regional police chief Andriy Nebyutov, adding that more than 20 people were hospitalized. Just hours earlier, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida left Kyiv after meeting Zelensky in a show of support for Ukraine. Earlier Wednesday, Chinese leader Xi Jinping left Moscow after meeting with President Vladimir Putin and discussing his peace proposal, which has been rejected by the West as a non-starter. Zaporizhia's regional administration said two missiles struck the apartment block, saying Russia's goal is to scare the civilian population of the city of thousands. It's hell in Zaporizhia, Ukrainian lawmaker Oleksiy Goncharenko wrote on Telegram, adding there aren't any military facilities nearby. Vladimir Rogov, an official with the Moscow-appointed regional administration for the Russian-occupied part of the Zaporizhia region, claimed the building was hit by a Ukrainian air defense missile that was launched to intercept a Russian missile. He didn't offer any evidence to support his claim. Russian officials have blamed Ukrainian air defenses for some of the deadliest strikes on apartments in the past, charging that the deployment of air defense systems in residential areas puts civilians at risk. Ukrainian air defenses downed 16 of the 21 drones launched by Russia, the Ukraine general staff said. Eight were shot down near the capital, according to the city's military administration. Other drone attacks struck central western Khmelnytsky province. Ukraine's finance ministry said it has agreed with the International Monetary Fund on a $15.6 billion loan package aimed at shoring up the country's economy, which has been crippled by the invasion. Ukrainian officials hope the IMF deal will encourage their allies to provide financial support, too. We are approaching 8:30, and of course, at 8:30, we turn to our obituaries. We read only the name, age, and location if it is a given. If you would like any further information about any of the obituaries today, please visit this site. It is at legacy.com/obituaries/Kentucky. Again, that site for additional information is legacy.com/obituaries/Kentucky. Also, you can now call us at our Radio Eye studios at 859-422-6390, and we will try to read them to you over the phone. Again, you can now call us at our Radio Eye studios at 859-422-6390, and we will try to read those obituaries to you over the phone. The Obituary Index. Ginger Lynn Blevins Paxton, age 56, Nicholasville. L. Winston Bridges, Jr., age 56, Mount Olivet. Betty Carol Birchfield, age 85, Stamping Ground. Barbara Ann Campbell, age 68, Richmond. Charlene Craycraft, age 81, Cynthiana. Larry Monroe Ferris, age 76, Lexington. Thomas Bartram Givan, age 96, Shepherdsville. Willis Bill Hendren, age 94, Lexington. Boyd Hoskins, age 90, Liberty. Matthew Jacobson, age 66, Versailles. Lester Jones, age 74, London. Lorraine LaChapelle Blanchard, age 90, Versailles. Susan Merritt, age 67, Winchester. James Riddle, age 78, Paris. Dennis Rogers, age 49, Liberty. Keith Schrack, age 73, Webville. Alan Dwayne Thompson, age 71, Liberty. Bobby Tucker, age 88, Lexington. Wanda Walker, age 90, Hazard. Millard Ike Whitlock, age 78, Georgetown. So now we're going to turn to articles from pages 2 through 14 of today's edition. We will continue reading articles that tend to have a focus or impact somehow, some way on our lives here in Kentucky. From page 2, our first article to start us off in this second half hour is entitled, Kentucky's flu season has been especially deadly for children, and it's not quite over yet. The article is written by Jackie Starkey of the Herald Leader. Monday marked the start of spring, but winter respiratory viruses are still circulating. Flu activity, which can last well into the spring months in Kentucky, is increasing in some areas, including Fayette County, according to the latest update from the State Cabinet for Health and Family Services. In its most recent seasonal report, which includes data from March 5th to 11th, the Cabinet reported 9 counties in the Commonwealth are seeing an increase in flu activity over the week prior. Fayette, Letcher, Perry, Leslie, Knott, Breathitt, Owsley, Lee, and Wolfe. Most of Kentucky has plateaued in the more recent reporting week, meaning no change in activity since previous week, per the State Department for Public Health. Flu activity in Kentucky and the U.S. Over the most recent reporting week, there were 96 new laboratory-confirmed cases of the flu in the state, bringing the total to 42,372 for the season. Health officials caution these numbers reflect only a portion of real flu cases during any given period. 140 people have died of the flu in the state this winter, 9 of whom were younger than 18. The state health department reports 6 individuals have died from a flu and COVID-19 co-infection. Pediatric flu deaths in the state reached a record high in December. The current flu season had tied with the 2019-20 season as the deadliest on record for Kentucky children, with 6 deaths reported. At the time, Commissioner of the Department for Public Health, Dr. Stephen Stack, said that 2022-23's flu season was on track to be the worst in Kentucky in at least 10 years. In comparison, state data indicate that by the tail end of the 2019-20 flu season that May, more than 27,400 cases had been confirmed, a figure this year's flu season has already eclipsed. Though peak flu season usually runs from late January through February in the state, the illness saw an early wave late last year across the U.S. In Kentucky, cases peaked in November, according to state data, and have fallen off sharply since then. According to the latest federal overview from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Kentucky was seeing minimal flu activity for the week ending March 11. The CDC uses data on activity from the Influenza-Like Illness Surveillance Network. Flu activity in Lexington. Lexington has recorded nearly 3,400 confirmed flu cases this year, according to the Lexington-Fayette County Health Department, though the real number of cases is likely far higher. For the week running March 5 to 11, the health department reports 3 new cases with a total flu death toll there of 13. We've had cases into May before, so we are not finished with the flu season just yet, Kevin Hall, the health department's communications officer, told the Herald Leader late last month. Though he said interest in the flu shot has waned recently, the free vaccine is still available at the public health clinic at 650 Newtown Pike 3 days a week. You can call 859-288-2483, that's 859-288-2483, to make an appointment. And you can also get your COVID-19 shot while there. Next article, page 2, entitled, Teenager Accused of a Lexington Murder Was on Parole After Prior Robbery. Articles written by Carla Ward and Christopher Leach, both of the Lexington Herald Leader. Two people have been arrested in connection with a fatal shooting outside a Lexington gas station last weekend. Lexington police said Tuesday night that Marquan King, 19, had been arrested and charged with murder, second-degree assault, and possession of a handgun by a convicted felon in connection with the shooting Friday night at the Marathon station in the 300 block of North Martin Luther King Boulevard. A second man, Lamont Claiborne, 21, was arrested and charged with tampering with physical evidence. Surveillance footage captured King in the area of the shooting at the time it occurred, according to court documents. It shows King approach the victims, shoot them, then flee on foot. Claiborne was observed fleeing from police with an ankle monitor that had been removed, according to court documents. The coroner's office said Justin Cook, 43, was pronounced dead at University of Kentucky Chandler Hospital as a result of the shooting Friday night. Police said a woman was also shot and was taken to a local hospital with injuries that were not life-threatening. It was Lexington's second homicide of 2023. King and Claiborne were being held in the Fayette County Detention Center, police said. Claiborne was later discharged from jail via administrative release, according to court records. Murder suspect was on parole in a robbery case. King was previously convicted of second-degree robbery but was out on parole when he allegedly killed Cook, according to state records. In April 2019, King and another individual were arrested and charged with first-degree robbery after being pulled over by police in a stolen vehicle, according to court documents. The other individual admitted to stealing the car with King, and a handgun was found in the glove compartment of the vehicle. In December 2019, King accepted a plea agreement that amended his first-degree robbery charge down to second-degree robbery and dismissed an additional charge of possessing a handgun as a minor, according to court documents. Approximately 4 months later, King was sentenced to 10 years in prison. King was granted parole in April 2021 and released from prison, according to the Kentucky Department of Corrections website. As a person convicted of a Class C felony that didn't involve death or physical injury, King was eligible for parole after serving 20% of his sentence, according to state law. He was scheduled to be on parole until June 2026. While out on parole, King was also charged in November 2021 with possessing a firearm as a convicted felon, according to court records. He was indicted on the charge in January 2022 but released from jail after posting bond. His next court date for that case was scheduled for next week, according to court records. Court records indicate King was released on bond with certain conditions, including electronic ankle monitoring. From page 3 of the Lexington Herald Leader, article entitled, Jury Awards $14 Million to Kentucky Doctor Who Lost License in Federal Drug Case. The article is written by Bill Estep of the Herald Leader. A Kentucky doctor accused of writing improper drug prescriptions won a $14 million judgment in a case in which he argued pharmacy companies wrongly attributed drug orders to him, making it more likely he would be charged with a crime. A jury in Perry County returned the verdict last week in favor of James Dustin Cheney in his lawsuit against CVS and Rite Aid of Kentucky. Jurors in his lawsuit found that the two pharmacy companies knowingly or recklessly reported that he wrote prescriptions he really hadn't. This put Cheney in a false light as someone who had written a large amount of prescriptions for powerful opioid painkillers, jurors ruled. Painkillers such as those have been responsible for thousands of deaths and overdoses in Kentucky. Cheney was charged in 2014 with prescribing drugs illegally and ultimately sentenced to 30 months in federal prison. The jury awarded Cheney $10 million for past, present, and future mental anguish, $2.5 million for lost wages, and $1.5 million for impairment to his ability to earn money, according to the verdict form. The jury put the liability for the damages at 53% for CVS and 45% for Rite Aid, according to Laura Clay Parker, one of Cheney's attorneys. Each company would have to pay that percentage amount of the award. The jury attributed 1% of the liability to a third company, RX Discount Pharmacy, and said Cheney was responsible for 1% of the damage he suffered by not doing enough to monitor prescribing data about himself. An attorney representing Rite Aid declined comment on whether the company will appeal the judgment. A spokesman for CVS said the company respectfully disagrees with the verdict and is reviewing options, including whether to appeal. Cheney lost his medical license as a result of the 2014 criminal case, but plans to ask the state to reinstate his license. We are thankful that the jury rendered a just verdict in Dr. Cheney's case, and we look forward to bringing this evidence before the Kentucky Board of Medical Licensure, Parker said. Cheney grew up in Hazard and returned there to practice after attending medical school at the University of Pikeville and work at the University of Kentucky and the University of Tennessee, according to court documents. In 2010, he opened a pain clinic called Clarion Health and Wellness in Hazard. Cheney hired an unemployed doctor, Andrew Krzyzewski, whose field was obstetrics and gynecology, to see patients at Clarion while Cheney worked at a hospital. Cheney intended to run a legitimate pain clinic, but wasn't able to hire a specialist in pain management, according to court documents. In the summer of 2012, Cheney started to notice Krzyzewski was overprescribing drugs and dispensing high dosages of drugs to patients. He advised Krzyzewski to lower the amount of drugs he prescribed, according to a court document, but didn't get rid of him or close the clinic, which he sold in December 2012. A federal grand jury indicted Cheney on charges including conspiring to illegally distribute drugs, operating Clarion as a pill mill, and conspiracy to commit money laundering. Krzyzewski and the officer manager at Clarion, Benny Ray Bailey Jr., also were charged. Krzyzewski died by suicide while the charges were pending. Bailey pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit money laundering. He said in his plea he told Cheney of concerns about improper prescribing by Krzyzewski, but Cheney rebuffed him. Cheney pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit money laundering, meaning using money generated by improper prescribing for loan payments and other costs. He acknowledged that he deliberately closed his eyes to the fact that Krzyzewski was overprescribing, according to his plea agreement. Even before he was sentenced, however, attorneys for Cheney filed a lawsuit claiming that CVS and Rite Aid had provided incorrect information to a Kentucky program that tracks prescriptions. Prescriptions were attributed to Cheney that he didn't write or that were not authentic or complete, making it look like he was prescribing more drugs than he really was, which made it more likely police would investigate him, the complaint claimed. Parker Cheney's attorney said about half the prescriptions Rite Aid logged under Cheney's name should not have been attributed to him, and about 30% at CVS. Cheney recognized the problem when he kept getting notices about prescriptions filled in his name after he had given up his license, Parker said. One piece of evidence in the lawsuit was an internal document from CVS in which the company acknowledged hundreds of misattributed prescriptions in Cheney's name, Parker said. The jury ruled CVS and Rite Aid did not use proper care in putting information about Cheney into the monitoring system between 2010 and 2014. Parker represented Cheney along with Cody McElvoy, Jeffrey Morgan, and Jeremy Morgan. Page 3. Article entitled, Reports, New York DA Postpones Trump Grand Jury Session. The article is written by Michael R. Sizak and Eric Tucker of the Associated Press. New York. Manhattan prosecutors postponed a scheduled grand jury session Wednesday in the investigation into Donald Trump over hush money payments during his 2016 presidential campaign, at least temporarily slowing a decision on whether to charge the ex-president. The postponement was confirmed by four people familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity to the Associated Press because they were not authorized to discuss an ongoing investigation by name. The grand jurors were told to be on standby for Thursday, another day when the New York panel has been meeting in recent weeks. When the grand jurors next meet, they may hear from yet another witness, according to a person familiar with proceedings that appear to be nearing a decisive vote on whether to indict Trump. The panel has been probing Trump's involvement in a $130,000 payment made in 2016 to porn actor Stormy Daniels to keep her from going public about a sexual encounter she said she had with Trump years earlier. Trump has denied the claim, insisting he did nothing wrong, and assailed the investigation led by Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg as politically motivated. Wednesday's abrupt development, which a person familiar with the matter said was not connected to security concerns, came amid growing expectation that Trump could soon be charged. Grand jury proceedings are shrouded in secrecy, making it hard to predict with certainty what action might be taken and when. As the panel has been hearing from final witnesses, Trump has contended his arrest is imminent, and law enforcement officials have accelerated security preparations in the event of unrest accompanying an unprecedented charge against a former U.S. president. The district attorney's office declined to comment on the postponement. Prosecutors had recently invited Trump himself to appear before the grand jury and on Monday heard from a witness favorable to his case as a way to ensure that the panel would be presented with any information that could conceivably be considered exculpatory. Trump over the weekend stated that he expected to be arrested on Tuesday, though the day came and went without that happening. Turning now to page 5 of the Lexington Herald Leader, article entitled "Kentucky Second Grader Killed When Basketball Goal Fell on Him. Family Donates His Heart of Gold." The article is written by Valerie Honeycutt Spears of the Lexington Herald Leader. An 8-year-old boy from Corbin who died Monday was out of the ordinary for a second grader, a natural athlete and a top student, his principal said. Eli Hill could do things that were out of the ordinary for a second grade student, especially in math and reading, said Corbin Primary School Principal Travis Wilder. He was the kind of kid that would stop and help somebody he didn't even know, said Corbin's independent superintendent, David Cox. Eli died Monday evening while playing basketball at his family's home in Corbin, according to his mother and local officials. The Fayette County Coroner's Office said the backboard of the basketball goal fell off the post. It fell on top of him, leaving him with blunt force trauma to the chest. He died at University of Kentucky Medical Center. His mother, Ashley Hill, said the family donated Eli's organs. Eli had a heart of gold, and somebody else has that heart now, Ashley Hill, Eli's mother said. Tuesday in an interview. We know it was somebody else's answered prayer this morning to get that call. There is somebody out there with new corneas, she said. Ashley Hill was a former teacher and the chief academic officer for the Corbin Independent School District who recently went to work for the Kentucky Department of Education. I always knew that Eli was going to do something special with his life, but I didn't know this was it, Ashley Hill said. He was brilliant, and I'm not just saying that because he's mine. He talked early. He walked early. He was so intuitive. He felt deeply for people. He loved people, and he loved God. I just miss my baby, and I want people to know his life mattered, she said. The students are devastated. Eli was a leader for his age, said Wilder. He was just well-liked. He was a natural athlete. He was a shining star at our school. The students are devastated at his passing. He was so loved, said Eli's father, Adam Hill. Eli had an older sister and a younger brother. Yesterday afternoon around 5 p.m., there was a tragic accident involving a Corbin primary student, a message posted on the Corbin Independent Schools District website said Monday. The young man was at his home playing basketball, and the goal structure he was playing on collapsed and fell on top of him. Ashley Hill said she was inside their home cooking supper, and Eli was in the driveway playing basketball when the incident occurred. He pulled a chair over to dunk the basketball, and at some point the goal fell off and crushed Eli's chest, she said. The Fayette County Coroner's Office confirmed the basketball goal fell on Eli at his home and that he died at the pediatric emergency room at University of Kentucky Medical Center. The cause of death was blunt force trauma, the coroner's office said. Page 4, article entitled, "Here's the Top Invasive Plants to Look Out for in Your Kentucky Backyard This Spring," article written by Aaron Mudd of the Lexington Herald Leader. From kudzu to your common backyard honeysuckle, invasive plant species are spreading unchecked across Kentucky, crowding out natives and throwing ecosystems out of balance. If you're not watchful, some of the more troublesome species, like poison hemlock, can take over your backyard. We've rounded up some tips to help you identify and remove a few of these problematic plants this spring and get a handle on this seemingly never-ending battle. What makes a species invasive, and how do they spread? For a species to be considered invasive, it has to meet two major criteria. It must be non-native to the ecosystem it inhabits, and it must cause harm. That's according to the National Wildlife Federation, which reports roughly 42% of threatened or endangered species on Earth are at risk because of invasives. To be considered invasive, a species doesn't have to come from some far-off country. Lake trout from the Great Lakes, for example, are considered invasive in Yellowstone and Wyoming because they compete with native trout. Without the presence of natural predators, parasites, diseases, and competitors, invasive species can spread unchecked and crowd out the natives. Generally speaking, any species that grows and reproduces quickly and spreads aggressively with the potential to cause harm is labeled as invasive. The damage invasive species unleash extends beyond ecosystems, but to human health and economies as well, with the National Wildlife Federation putting the cost at billions of dollars each year. Healthy native ecosystems underpin many of our commercial, agricultural, and recreational activities. Humans are instrumental in the spread of invasive species around the world. Sometimes it's intentional, like the introduction of kudzu to the U.S. in the late 1800s. While they first came here as an ornamental plant, kudzu was later grown as a crop for livestock to forage and to stabilize the soil. Under the right conditions, it can grow 2 inches in a single day. Left unchecked, it can take over woodlands, stream banks, and even old farmsteads. What are the most invasive species in Kentucky? The Kentucky Exotic Pest Plant Council has identified at least 145 invasive plants in the state and put an additional 35 on its watch list. Here's a look at some of the most recognizable invasive plant species, which the Kentucky Exotic Pest Plant Council calls severe threats. Poison hemlock. As its name suggests, poison hemlock is fatal to humans and animals if ingested. A pretty plant with delicate white flowers that resemble Queen Anne's lace or wild carrots, it was the poison used to kill the Greek philosopher Socrates, and it's spreading in Kentucky. The stems of the plant have purple splotches, which can help with identifying it. It exhibits fern-like leaves, and its flowers come into bloom in early June. Queen Anne's lace, another invader, is similar, but not as threatening. It's sometimes called chiggerweed for its ability to harbor itchy mites that can spread to your exposed skin upon contact with the plant. Unlike poison hemlock, Queen Anne's lace has hair on its stems and petioles, the part of the plant that attach the leaf to the stem. Mowing or cutting down poison hemlock is an option, but it should be done before it flowers and produces seed. Spraying is another alternative and is best done in the spring and fall when it grows in its rosette shape as a young plant. Bush honeysuckle. Bush honeysuckle refers to several species, but the most common variety in Kentucky is the Amur honeysuckle, according to the University of Kentucky's Department of Forestry and Natural Resources. A native of northern China, Korea, and parts of Japan, it was first introduced into the U.S. in 1897. Escapees from ornamental plantings were first recorded in the 1920s and promoted for conservation and wildlife uses in the 1960s and 70s. Though it was once thought it could only tolerate central Kentucky soil types, bush honeysuckle can actually grow under moderate light conditions and survive in many soil types. Amur honeysuckle is most common in northern and central Kentucky, though now it's spreading across the state. The Amur species flowers in June, and its white and yellow flowers can produce more than 1 million red seeds on mature plants, which can grow to be 20 feet tall. Removing the plant can be tough, given the size it can grow to, and methods vary based on the height of the plant in question. Kentucky Woodlands magazine has information on different approaches to removal, including necessary stump removal. Tree of Heaven. A native of Asia, this fast-growing tree is spread throughout the U.S. It puts out wind-blown seeds that can sprout and rapidly grow into a large tree. According to Kentucky Woodlands magazine, Tree of Heaven has gray, smooth bark and can grow to a towering height of 80 feet tall if it allowed to grow unchecked. Its leaves are pinnately compound and oval-shaped, resembling a tropical palm tree. Because Tree of Heaven puts out root suckers or small trees that rise from its roots, simply hacking down the trees or pulling them up by their roots may not remove them unless they're quite small. More about invasive plants in Kentucky and alternatives. The Kentucky Exotic Pest Plant Council has an extensive list of native alternatives to plant in your backyard instead of invasive plants. A few they recommend include, instead of the invasive Tree of Heaven plant, the native Kentucky coffee tree. Tear down that honeysuckle and plant a native dogwood tree in its place. Instead of English ivy, plant Virginia creeper. The University of Kentucky's Department of Forestry and Environment also has resources to learn about and combat invasive plants in the state. Turning now to page 6. Headline: New Lexington Morning TV show will focus on local shops, restaurants, and lifestyle. The article is written by Janet Patton of the Lexington Herald Leader. A new local lifestyle television show is launching in Lexington. Live from Chevy Chase will debut March 27th on Fox 56. The 30-minute show will air at 9 a.m. weekday mornings with Tamara Schneider and Lee Jordan, collectively known as the Kentucky Taste Buds, as hosts. The TV show will focus on Central Kentucky shops and restaurants, according to the station. The Central Kentucky lifestyle economy is thriving, and new shops and restaurants are opening all over our community, said Monty Costas, general manager of Fox 56. Local television isn't really covering the lifestyle story, and that's why we're launching live from Chevy Chase. The Fox 56 television studio is in Chevy Chase on the corner of High Street and Euclid Avenue. And, according to the news release, it will be a live show. The audience doesn't know what's going to happen next, and neither do we, Jordan said in the release. Tam and I developed an unscripted spontaneity on our radio show that's frankly been missing from local television, and we can't wait to bring it to Fox 56. The lifelong friends launched a blog together that developed into a radio show that aired weekday mornings on KISS 96.9 at LM Communications. Schneider said that 75% to 85% of their show will be their finds and adventure with some paid content. Packages on restaurants such as Jay Render's Barbecue Restaurant and local sites such as the Mary Todd Lincoln House will be pre-taped to air on the live show, which also will feature cooking and cocktail making. Live from Chevy Chase is produced by and for Central Kentucky women with their own sense of style, said Schneider in the release. We're a mashup of classic Southern culture and the latest lifestyle trends. Our content is as eclectic as the Central Kentucky lifestyle. We have fashion influencers who do bougie on a budget, DIY decorators who do home hacks and makeovers, and weekend planners to fill your weekends with affordable fun. There's no better place to find out what's happening than Chevy Chase, Lexington's most vibrant shopping and dining neighborhood, Jordan said. Our studios are located between the energy of UK and the history of Ashland Park in a unique village of bars, boutiques, and restaurants. The station also is launching a new morning news show that will follow the lifestyle show at 9:30 a.m. The 30-minute newscast will be anchored by Krista Spadaccini and Chief Meteorologist Justin Logan. We're coming to the end of our time together this morning. We'll end up on the opinion page, and I'll share some of the headlines from the opinion page for you in case you would wish to pursue them on the Herald Leader website. At the top of the opinion page, we have an opinion by George Will of the Washington Post, "How Government Violates the Spirit of the First Amendment." We also have on the opinion page an article written by Melissa Ray Sanger with PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Melissa Ray Sanger is encouraging us to create a garden fit for a queen bee this spring, targeting the loss of bees population in this country. And then finally, rounding out the opinion page, we have "Want Better Government? We Need to Pay Bureaucrats More." And that's by Matthew Iglesias from Bloomberg in New York. This concludes the reading of the Lexington Herald Leader for today, Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. Your reader has been Woody Snowden with Bill Sally on the master controls. Thank you so much for listening, and now please stay tuned for sports news right here on Radio I.